Our text today is Luke chapter 9, verses 46 through 56, which contains an interesting combination of events. Verses 51 to 56 are unique to Luke, and we'll talk about the significance of that in a bit. But let's begin with at the beginning with one of the clearer points in the passage. He who is least among you, he is the greatest. Verses 46 to 48. An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. Then he said to them, "Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me, for he who is least among you all, he is the greatest." And it's that last line of verse 48 where Jesus succinctly summarizes his point and does so with one of his signature ironies. The least among you is the greatest. But before we unpack that, let's make sure we've got the action in focus. An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. The greatest what? The smartest? The richest? The handsomest? The tallest? Though it might be hard to quantify precisely, we instinctively understand what they were arguing about. They mean the most important, the most significant. And it's amusing to imagine how that argument might have gone. "I cast out more demons than you." "Yeah, but I passed out more loaves and fishes than you." "Yeah, but I prayed longer than you." "Yeah, but I gave up more to follow Jesus than you." And so on and so on. Now, it's important to pay attention to the next couple of verses because they often get overshadowed, as I'll show you in a minute. Verse 47. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. Then he said to them, "Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me." Now that is often eclipsed by the way Matthew recorded the event in his chapter 18. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called a little child and had him stand among them. And he said, "I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." And it's Matthew 18, verse 3, that's the key. "I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." That's the bit that everybody remembers. But changing and becoming like a little child is not the same thing as welcoming a little child. In Luke 9:48, it's "whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me." Now, becoming like a little child and welcoming a little child are resonant. They've got the same kind of vibe, but they are not the same thing. Matthew goes on to include the idea of welcoming in verse 5, "and whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me." So we're not talking about any sort of conflict between the accounts. I'm just saying that the idea of becoming like a child is the one people walk away with from this story, perhaps because it's simpler or more dynamic or memorable. But Luke does not mention it. He only talks about welcoming a little child. And the point there is that you would take the time to pay attention to a child, listen to them, treat them as important, and that would be remarkable because in the hustle and bustle of the grown-up world, little children are not important. So in their argument about who was the greatest, that is the most important, Jesus says the one who takes the time for the least important, he is the most important. Or to use the precise terms of the text, the one who takes time for the least is the greatest. And you might find the underlying Greek words memorable, or at least amusing. The word for least is mikros, comes into English as the prefix micro. And the word for greatest is megas, comes into English as the prefix mega. So if you want to be mega, you got to be micro. For he who is mikros among you all, he is the megas. I call this one of Jesus' signature ironies. Dictionary definition of irony: incongruity between what might be expected and what actually occurs. It would seem reasonable to expect that the greatest would be the greatest. The least is the greatest. As the Son is revealing the Father, as in terms of Romans 12:2, our minds are being transformed rather than conformed, we learn how different God's ways are from our ways. Isaiah 55:8-9, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." In the economy of earth, the greatest is the greatest, but in the economy of heaven, the least is the greatest. In Mark's account, in his chapter 9, he uses the terms first and last. If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for Jesus' sake will save it, Luke 9:24. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted, Luke 14:11. Over and over, we are told the world's way and heaven's way are polar opposites. And of the bottomless treasures to unpack here, we'll just focus on the one relative to our passage, which is the matter of framework, perspective, how you see things. As the disciples were arguing about who was the greatest, they had a common agreement, a shared assumption, which was that they were playing a zero-sum game. A zero-sum game is a situation where whatever resources, there's a limited amount of whatever resources you're after, money, glory, love, or whatever. Musical chairs is literally a zero-sum game. In order for me to have a seat, there's one less seat for everybody else. Now, if there were a finite amount of, let's say, glory, because it was a finite amount, in order for me to get more, somebody else would have to have less. A zero-sum game is, by definition, a competition. In order for me to get higher, somebody has to get lower. In order for me to get richer, somebody has to get poorer. Now I'm going to mention a profound truth, but only glancingly, and it is this. The thing we're all after, the ultimate thing, is the approval of God. As it's said in the parable of the talents, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share in your master's happiness." That is the ultimate win. The final end point of every desire. And in their heart of hearts, whether people know it or not, that is everyone's deepest desire. And the wonderful news is, it's not a zero-sum game. In order for God to approve more of me, he does not have to approve less of you. There is no limit to the extent to which we can gain God's approval. In fact, a significant part of my gaining his approval is me enabling and empowering you to gain his approval, which I trust you can see makes it the exact opposite of a zero-sum game. We're not competing. We are, or should be, cooperating. It's not the higher you get, the lower I get. It's the higher I can get you, the higher I can get myself. That's how the least becomes the greatest. The more you give up and give away for others, the greater you become. Now, verses 49 and 50. "Master," said John, "we saw a man driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he is not one of us." "Do not stop him," Jesus said, "for whoever is not against you is for you." There's another of Jesus' pithy sayings, Luke 9:50, "Whoever is not against you is for you." And if you seem to remember that the other way around, like "whoever is not with me is against me," that's because Jesus also said that in another context. Luke records that in chapter 11, verse 23. Now, on the relationship between the statements, "whoever is not against you is for you," and whoever is not for you is against you, we'll just note that they are proverbial statements and thus general principles. They aren't intended to be understood as being true in any and every case. And they kind of conflict a bit with one another. We've got proverbs that do that. Look before you leap, and he who hesitates is lost. Okay? Think about that. Those proverbs give conflicting advice, but they don't contradict one another because they're general principles. They're not true in any in every situation. One applies in one set of circumstances and the other in another. So as always, the key to understanding the meaning is context. And in our context, the disciples saw someone driving out demons in Jesus' name and tried to stop him because he wasn't in the group. As John put it, he is not one of us. And Jesus says, no, you got that wrong. Don't stop him, because whoever is not against you is for you. So the point here is about sectarianism, petty sectarianism, thinking that anybody who's not doing it exactly the way you are isn't doing it right. It's a normal, and I would say, I'm inclined to say basic human trait. You grow up in a family that did things a certain way. And then you get exposed to others who do things differently. They do breakfast differently or arrange their house differently or whatever. And the initial impulse is to feel they're not doing it right. But most of us outgrow that feeling at that level. But it also applies at higher levels and can be more difficult to outgrow. And here Jesus is just saying, hold on, we got a big tent here. There's plenty of room for people to find their own way. Everybody doesn't have to do it the same way, and everybody doesn't have to do it your way. One point of relevance for us would be how you do church. For example, the difference between high church and low church. I don't know if you're familiar with those terms, but here at Shepherd's Gate, we are a very low church. We're informal, we're unscripted, we're unhierarchical. This would be over and against, say, Roman Catholicism, which is a very high church. It's formal, liturgical, hierarchical, incense, cathedrals, blah, blah, blah. Now, Roman Catholicism has a lot of problems, but being a high church is not one of them. Low church, high church, it makes no difference. Think of it in terms of package and contents. Imagine something precious, like a bar of gold. And then imagine it's wrapped in a beautiful package. Then take that same bar of gold and imagine it's just stuck in a paper sack. Completely different packaging, bar of gold is still a bar of gold. And that gospel, the gospel of Jesus Christ, is like that bar of gold, pure and enduring. How we do church, whether you like stained glass windows or clear windows, whether you like current music or traditional music, whether you put on your Sunday best or come as you are, that's just packaging. Roman Catholicism has a lot of content problems, but the package isn't an issue. Paul touches on this in Romans 14, where he says, "Accept him whose faith is weak without passing judgment on disputable matters. One man's faith allows him to eat everything, but another man whose faith is weak is a vegan. The man who eats everything must not look down on him who does not, and the man who does not eat everything must not condemn the man who does, for God has accepted him. Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To his own master he stands or falls, and he will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand. One man considers one day more sacred than another. Another man considers every day alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind." The problems arise when we take what he calls disputable matters and make a big deal out of them. Paul continues, "He who regards one day as special does so to the Lord. He who eats meat eats to the Lord, for he gives thanks to God. And he who abstains does so to the Lord and gives thanks to God. For none of us lives to himself alone, and none of us dies to himself alone. If we live, we live in the Lord, and if we die in the Lord. So whether we live or die, we belong to the Lord. For this very reason, Christ died and returned to life, so that he might be the Lord of both the dead and the living. You then, why do you judge your brother? Or why do you look down on your brother? For we will all stand before God's judgment seat. It is written, as surely as I live, says the Lord, every knee will bow before me, every tongue will confess to God. So then, each of us will give an account of himself to God. That's Romans 14:12, and one of my very favorite verses in the Bible. Each of us will give an account of himself to God. Who are you going to give an account of? Yourself. Who are you in charge of? Yourself. Who do you need to be critical of? Yourself. There's a limitless number of things that can divide us, innumerable issues we can argue about. Don't do it. Don't waste the time or the effort. Whoever is not against you is for you. Now, I'm going to do something I don't ordinarily do, and that is tell a joke I've told before. And I'm going to do that because, one, it's spot on for this issue, and two, I just like it. To illustrate the foolishness of divisions among Christians, one guy told the following story. Once, he said, I saw this guy on a bridge about to jump. I said, don't do it. He said, nobody loves me. I said, God loves you. Do you believe in God? He said, yes. I said, are you a Christian or a Jew? He said, a Christian. I said, me too. Protestant or Catholic? He said, Protestant. I said, me too. What franchise? He said, Baptist. I said, me too. Northern Baptist or Southern Baptist? He said, Northern Baptist. I said, me too. Northern Conservative Baptist or Northern Liberal Baptist? He said, Northern Conservative Baptist. I said, me too. He said, Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region or Northern Conservative Baptist Eastern region? He said, Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region. I said, me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1879 or Northern Conservative Baptist Council, Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912. He said, Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912. I said, die, heretic, and pushed him off the bridge. No two of us see things exactly the same way. We need to understand and appreciate that God extends to others the same grace that we live by. So don't waste your time judging others. You will give an account of yourself to God. You're the only person you need to judge. Now we come to verse 51, a verse whose significance, I think, will surprise you. It says, as the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. Okay, what's so significant about that? Well, at this point, we're going to pull back from exegesis. That's where you talk about the meaning of the text. Pull back from that, change the subject, and talk about the structure of the text, how it is arranged. Because in the Gospel of Luke, this verse is the pivot point, the fulcrum on which the whole story turns. As you know, there are four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, four different takes on the ministry of Jesus. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are similar enough to be called the synoptic, sin, same, optic, perspective, same, the same perspective Gospels, because they tend to tell the story in the same way. To be sure, there are interesting variations among them, but in general, they're all singing the same song. John, on the other hand, had a unique approach, and thank God for that. Now, among the gospel writers, Matthew and John were apostles, two of the 12. Mark was closely associated with Peter, so closely associated that Mark effectively is the gospel of Peter. But Luke's kind of out there. His apostolic connection was with Paul, who was not one of the 12. First time Paul met Jesus was Acts chapter 9, on the road to Damascus. Luke was a Gentile medical doctor who converted under the ministry of Paul and then traveled with him in support of his ministry. Went into some detail on this in our introduction to the Gospel of Luke. That sermon is dated January 16th, 2022, and available online if you care to consult it. But what I want to remind you of at this point is, Paul spent two apparently useless years in prison waiting for the Roman governor to hear his case, Acts 24:27. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. Those are the Roman governors of Judea. But because Felix wanted to grant the Jews a favor, he left Paul in prison. Now we know from other references in Acts that Luke was traveling with Paul at the time. And I'm here to tell you, those two apparently useless years Paul spent in prison, during those 2 years, Luke was carefully investigating everything from the beginning. Remember that phrase from his prologue, chapter 1, verses 1 through 4? Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Matthew was an eyewitness, John was an eyewitness, Peter was an eyewitness, Luke was not an eyewitness. Therefore, he says, since I have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. While Paul was imprisoned in Caesarea, a Roman city on the coast, Luke went inland to Jerusalem and Nazareth and Bethany and Capernaum. Maybe talked with Mary, the mother of Jesus, and learned there was no room for them at the inn. Maybe talked with Martha, the sister of Lazarus, and learned she'd been worried and upset about many things. Maybe met Zacchaeus, who was a wee little man. He carefully investigated everything and then wrote his orderly account. You see the phrase, resolutely set out for Jerusalem? Circle it, underline it, highlight it, put stars around it. Do whatever you do to mark it as significant, because that's the pivot point. From this point until the triumphal entry, which Luke begins in his chapter 19, verse 28, Luke 9:51 to 19:28, effectively 10 chapters, Luke frames as a single journey, a straight shot to Jerusalem. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem, and virtually all of the material in those 10 chapters is found only in Luke. You know how we preachers have been comparing our passages in Luke with the way Matthew puts it or the way Mark puts it? Did it earlier this sermon. Talked about how the fact that Matthew recorded, unless you change and become like little children, tends to overshadow Luke's record. Mentioned that instead of least and greatest, Mark used first and last. Throughout much of the gospel story, Matthew, Mark, and Luke enable us to triangulate and obtain a fuller picture of what's going on. That's not going to be happening in the next 10 chapters of Luke, because virtually everything in them is unique to Luke. Parable of the Good Samaritan, only in Luke. The parable of the prodigal son is only in Luke. Martha worried and upset about many things, only in Luke. Zacchaeus was a wee little man, only in Luke. Parable of the shrewd manager, only in Luke. Parable of the rich fool, only in Luke. Rich man and Lazarus, only in Luke. The 10 lepers, only in Luke. Parable of the persistent widow, only in Luke. The parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector is only found in Luke. I hope you are getting the picture. There is an enormous and unfathomably precious amount of information about God and Jesus and life and death and heaven and hell that we get only from Luke. Only because he took the trouble to carefully investigate everything from the beginning and write an orderly account so that we may know the certainty of the things we have been taught. I'm going to high five Luke in heaven. Got to tell him, thank you, thank you, thank you for what you did. And remember to thank Paul for spending 2 years in prison so he could do it. Now, I've told you that Luke 9:51 is the pivot point. In order to show you it's as important as I'm saying it is, here's half a dozen references to the journey on the way. Luke 13:22. Then Jesus went through the towns and villages, teaching as he made his way to Jerusalem. 13:33. In any case, I must keep going today and tomorrow and the next day, for surely no prophet can die outside Jerusalem. 17:11. Now on his way to Jerusalem, Jesus traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee. 18:31. Jesus took the 12 aside and told them, "We are going up to Jerusalem." 19:11. He went on to tell them a parable because he was near Jerusalem. And 19:28, the closing verse of the section, after Luke had said this, after Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. So that's why you should circle, underline, highlight, or whatever, Luke 9:51. Luke tells us he wrote an orderly account, and that is the key to his order. Though I'd be remiss if I didn't mention another important aspect of Luke 9:51, and that is its tone. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. You know, if I'd written that, I probably would have phrased it, as the time approached for him to be crucified, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem, which would have been factually correct, though in light of what Luke actually wrote, rather short-sighted. Yeah, it's a glass half empty, half full deal, fair enough, but perspective is so powerful. And we know that what Luke wrote reflects Jesus' perspective, because Hebrews 12:2 says, "Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross." So he resolutely set out for Jerusalem because the time was approaching for him to be taken to heaven. Then we come to the closing verses in our passage, 52 through 56. "And he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. When the disciples, James and John, saw this, they asked, 'Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to destroy them?' But Jesus turned and rebuked them, and they went to another village." So he begins his journey to Jerusalem in the south, from Galilee in the north, but in between lies Samaria. And Samaria was there because when the northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians in 722 BC, the Assyrians imported other conquered peoples into the area. Open border kind of thing. And the immigrants mixed with the native Jews and produced an ethnically and religiously hybrid population. You can read about it in 2 Kings 17. Anyway, they eventually developed a rival Bible and a rival temple. So not surprisingly, Jews didn't like Samaritans, and Samaritans didn't like Jews. So when traveling between Galilee and Jerusalem, Jews would walk around Samaria rather than through it. But Jesus, being Jesus, did things his own way, wanted to provide the Samaritans an opportunity to respond to him, as they had responded quite positively in John chapter 4. But this time they weren't having any of it because he was headed for Jerusalem. And that ticked James and John off, so they, coming to Jesus' defense, proactively ask, "Lord, you want us to call fire down from heaven to destroy them?" And before we take them to task for their attitude, let's commend the faith that had them believing they had the power to call down fire from heaven. In case you're not familiar with the backstory, they are in full Elijah mode here. Elijah being the prophet who called down fire from heaven. And that might make you think of his famous run-in with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. That's 1 Kings 18, which, though relevant, is not the primary reference. The primary reference is 2 Kings 1, where evil king Ahaziah summons Elijah, sends him, picking it up at 2 Kings 1:9, a captain with his company of 50 men. The captain went up to Elijah, who was sitting on the top of the hill, and said to him, "Man of God, the king says, come down." Elijah answered the captain, "If I am a man of God, may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men." Then fire fell from heaven and consumed the captain and his men. So the king sent another captain with 50 men. Same thing happened. So the king sent another captain with 50 men, but this captain was a little smarter and a little humbler than the other two. So instead of commanding Elijah to come down, He said, excuse me, Mr. Prophet, sir, I hope I'm not interrupting anything, but the king has ordered me to ask you pretty please, if it's not too much trouble, would you please come down and see him, please? And so Elijah went. Well, James and John surely felt that they were defending Jesus' honor and God's. How dare those Samaritans diss Jesus, who graciously and generously offered to bless them with his presence? But Jesus didn't see it that way. This is the same Jesus who said of those who were crucifying him, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Luke 23:34. And Jesus said this because it wasn't the time for consequences. It isn't the season for judgment. Now that season is coming, and I hope it comes soon, but it is not here yet. When God judges, he brings the just consequences of their actions on evildoers. The same Jesus who prayed for the forgiveness of his crucifiers is going to sweep down from heaven and judge the world someday. The exact same Jesus, but it will be a different season. Right now, the gates of heaven are open, and the call goes out to any and all to come in. Quoted Isaiah 55:8-9 earlier about talking about the least and the greatest, how different God's ways are from our ways. Well, the verses immediately preceding that read, seek the Lord while he may be found, call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the evil man his thoughts. Let him turn to the Lord, and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. The gracious and free offer of forgiveness makes no more sense to the world than does the least being the greatest. Well, that was how God was operating then, and it's how he's operating now, but it is not always going to be that way. Strange as it may seem, the gospel is a limited time offer. Now, it's always been that way in the personal sense, because everybody's going to die, and you've got to get right with God before that happens. But it's also limited in the collective, global sense. Sin doesn't just get to go on and on and on. It must be judged, and it will be judged. Certainly a main takeaway from this incident is that we must remember we live by the same grace that keeps others from being judged immediately. Amen. But in light of current world circumstances, I'm going to draw a different application. The Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes famously tells us there's a time for everything and a season for every activity under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build. And though Solomon didn't use these precise terms, it's certainly true that there's a time for grace and a time for judgment. The time for grace was initiated when Jesus first came. The time for judgment will be consummated when he returns. And he gave us signs, told us what it was going to look like shortly before he returned. Now, I am a student of history, and I'm well aware that down through the ages, time and again, people have looked at the mess the world is in and believed the end was near. But I assure you, the current world circumstances in which we find ourselves are utterly unprecedented. This many people, with this level of technology, with this level of hostility, with this level of integration, have never existed before. And by integration, I am referring to the globalist cabal at the top, which is purposefully wrecking the world so that it will collapse, so that they can build it back better on their globalist, socialist, transhumanist, depopulationist terms. That's what's going on the human level. Now, of course, biblically, we understand principalities and powers are behind the scenes driving things, and God is over it all, sovereignly accomplishing his purpose. Obviously, there's all sorts of arguments and all sorts of perspectives about what's going on. My goal is to inform you and encourage you in clear biblical terms, which I think are pretty easy to understand. Beginning in Matthew 24:3, we read, Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." Now I read that, and I look around, and I go, deception? Check. Wars and rumors of wars? Check. Famines? Check. They are baked in. We're not feeling it yet, but there is no way to avoid what's coming. Pestilences? Check. One specific thing that I do not see is earthquakes. Now, I am neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, and this is not a prophecy. This is me, Chris Stewart, telling you on September 18th, 2022, my biblically informed expectation is that major earthquakes are on the horizon. I will be surprised if we do not see them soon. Now, I said my goal was to inform and encourage you in clear biblical terms. Expect earthquakes. Brace for impact. There's the information. Where's the encouragement? Among all the literally apocalyptic information, it's easy to miss, but it's right there in Matthew 24:6. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. So when we hear about deception, war, famine, pestilence, and earthquakes, how are we supposed to keep from being troubled? We have to keep the big picture in view. Just like how I said if I'd written verse 51, I'd have written it as the time came for him to be crucified. But Luke wrote it as the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven. No doubt he was going to be crucified, but the story did not end there. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. How do we see to it that we're not troubled as the world around us falls apart? In Luke's parallel to Matthew 24, he records Jesus saying, Luke 21:28, "When these things begin to take place, stand up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near." So as the world gets worse and worse, our redemption draws nearer and nearer. Lift up your head. All shall be most well. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the golden, enduring, pure nature of your word, how we can always benefit and learn and grow as we pay attention to it and permit you to guide us through it. Covered a lot of territory. Lord, would you press into our hearts those things most needful for us to hear, whether it's not being troubled or not worrying about being the greatest or whatever. Thank you that our redemption draws near. May we glorify you and show you to others around us. Amen.